ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
When I stay at the Royal Society of London, just off the Mall, I always go to the first floor where a long hall with portraits of great scientists celebrates the best and the brightest. Along the window overlooking St James's Park is a row of busts, starting on the left with Charles Darwin. In the middle is the one I come to see. For me, the first scientist named in the English language. An intellect as formidable as any in the known universe. Her name? Yes, it's a woman. Was Mary Somerville. Today's Science Show with Sharon Carleton tells her incredible and moving story.
Mary Somerville was the most unlikely person to become a scientific superstar, albeit almost unknown today. And not just because she was a 19th century woman. A Needlework magazine led her to the thrill of understanding Newtonian mathematical physics. She grew up wild and uneducated in Scotland, yet her first book, written when she was in her 50s, became an advanced science reference book used at Cambridge University for a century. The Royal Society designated her one of the 10 women in history with the most influence on British science. In her memoir, Personal Recollections, Mary Somerville recalled,
"My mother taught me to read the Bible and to say my prayers. Otherwise, she allowed me to grow up a wild creature. When I was 7 or 8, I began to be useful. I pulled the fruit for preserving, shelled the peas and beans, fed the poultry, and looked after the dairy."
Mary Fairfax, as she was then, was born in 1780 in Scotland. Her father, who'd been sent to sea when he was a child, had almost no education, but read a great deal. Her mother occupied herself with religious texts and newspapers. Home from one of his voyages, her father was shocked that at 10, Mary could hardly read and couldn't write. He packed her off to boarding school.
"I was perpetually in tears. A few days after my arrival, I was enclosed in stiff stays with a steel busk in front, while above my frock, bands drew my shoulders back till the shoulder blades met. Then a steel rod with a semicircle which went under the chin was clasped to the steel busk in my stays. In this constrained state, I had to prepare our lessons."
It was physical and mental torture for the untamed young Mary. She had a year of rote learning from a dictionary and was shown the rudiments of writing and grammar. So how did this almost illiterate young girl start the metamorphosis into mathematical genius? Robin Arianrhod, a science star herself, is also an historian of science.
Her first inspiration was her love of nature, and while her brothers were away at school, she was left free to roam the beach, study the birds and the shells and the starfish and seaweed and coastal flowers, and she was entranced by that. When she did learn to read well enough to enjoy novels, she was told reading wasn't necessary or suitable for girls. Household chores and lessons in music and painting were more suitable for young ladies. She did have an aunt who owned a telescope, but the aunt used it solely to spy on the neighbours. But everything did begin to change for Mary when she attended a fateful tea party.
Still hoping to quell any intellectual tendencies, Mary was made to attend endless maiden aunt tea parties. And, now 15, she grudgingly accepted an invitation to admire someone's exquisite needlework and to look at sewing patterns. It was to be a pivotal point in her life.
She showed me a monthly magazine with coloured plates of ladies' dresses, charades and puzzles. At the end of the page, I read what appeared to be simply an arithmetical question, but I was surprised to see strange-looking lines mixed with letters, chiefly X's and Y's, and asked, "What is that?"
She went home and tried to find something with X's and Y's in it, but didn't have a lot of luck. She eventually plucked up the courage to ask her brother's tutor to buy her some maths textbooks. Still, it was difficult because she had to act as a lady during the day, doing her chores and practicing piano and painting. At night, she studied those textbooks with enormous zeal until it was noticed that the family stock of candles had run low unusually quickly. So her candles were confiscated. So then she had to improvise and lie awake in the dark trying to remember the Euclidean proofs that she'd studied because she was interested in geometry as well as algebra.
In 1804, Mary married her distant cousin, Samuel Grieg, who dismissed the intellectual abilities of all women and showed no interest in science. Again, she had to conceal her scholarly endeavours. Just 3 years into their marriage, Samuel Grieg died, leaving behind two sons. Here's Rona Doherty reading from Mary Somerville's Recollections.
I was much out of health after my husband's death and chiefly occupied with my children, but resumed my mathematical studies. I had studied plane and spherical trigonometry, conic sections, and Ferguson's astronomy. I attempted to read Newton's Principia.
After Samuel's death, Mary was left a little money of her own. She could at last buy the books she wanted on pure maths, algebra, differential and integral calculus, finite differences, geometry, logarithms, and The Mécanique Céleste by Pierre-Simon Laplace. Little knowing it would be thanks to Laplace that her name was to be carved in the rock of European science forever.
I could hardly believe that I possessed such a treasure of a library. When I look back on the day that I first heard the mysterious word algebra and the long course of years in which I had persevered almost without hope, it taught me never to despair.
After she came out of the requisite period of mourning, she discovered a mathematical journal called, I think it was the Mathematical Repository, published by a William Wallace. That journal published some mathematical puzzles. So Mary decided to enter some solutions. And Wallace, who was a self-taught mathematician himself and had become professor of mathematics at Edinburgh University, and he was so impressed with her efforts that he offered to help her. And eventually, in 1811, when she was 30, she won a silver medal in one of his problem-solving competitions. At last, she had some sort of public claim to being a mathematician. That was really the beginning, I think, after all those years. Half her lifetime ago was when she first discovered that first puzzle at 15 and wondered what X's and Y's were. And now, 15 years later, she had a silver medal. So she was pretty pleased.
Mary's second marriage to another cousin, Dr. William Somerville, in 1812, was the making of her. Contrary to the norms of the time, William supported Mary's scholarly interests, buying her more books and scientific instruments. Together they networked, as we'd say today, cultivating friends in the most prominent scientific circles, first in Edinburgh and then in London, where William went to practice medicine. But to really understand what made Mary Somerville so special, we need to appreciate the sheer brilliance of her friends and the utter complexity of their work. Because it was their work that Mary understood, analysed, critiqued, and then explained in simple terms to a lay audience and to other scientists. One of these early acquaintances was the astronomer William Herschel. Mary developed a strong intellectual bond with him and with his sister Caroline. William's scientific theories on the heavenly bodies influenced Mary enormously. Tony Christie is an independent science historian and author of the blog Renaissance Mathematicus, introducing the Herschels.
They were military musicians. They served in the Hanoverian army during the war against France. William, who was actually called Wilhelm in those days, fled to Britain as a deserter. He worked in north of England as a musician for a time and then got a job in Bath. And then he brought his sister over as his housekeeper. Caroline was handicapped. She suffered from typhus when she was 12 years old and it stunted her growth. She was 4'3", blind on one eye. Her parents didn't think she would be eligible to be married to anybody, so they turned her into a domestic slave. William rescued her and brought her to Bath to live with him, together with his brother Alexander. At the beginning, it was all music. At some point, and we don't really know why or how, William took up the hobby of becoming an astronomer. At the beginning, Caroline didn't like it. She thought he was wasting his time. He started observing, and then he decided that the telescopes weren't good enough, and he started building his own telescopes. At some point, Caroline got involved when you're doing reflecting telescopes, so they have a mirror. In order to grind and polish the mirrors and the lenses, you need to bed them in something, and they bed them in horse manure. And one of Caroline's jobs was to sieve the horse manure to get the straw out of it. He used to go out into the back garden and do his observing. One evening, he observed Uranus, and he actually thought it was a comet. He didn't realize that he'd discovered a new planet. The other planets were all known to the Greeks, to the Babylonians. He got appointed to become the king's astronomer, and they moved from Bath to a small village near Windsor. When William and Caroline split up because William got married and she moved out of the house, he actually built her a special telescope to look for comets, and she became an astronomer in her own right. And she actually discovered 8 comets and became the first woman to publish an article on astronomy in the Transactions of the Royal Society.
William Herschel sold his telescopes internationally, discovered some 2,500 celestial objects, published 3 catalogues, and discovered infrared rays.
He was looking at the spectra of astronomical objects. And he realized there was something outside of the range of the visual spectrum, why he began to investigate what it was at the one end of the spectrum. The other end, of course, is ultraviolet, but he didn't discover that. And he realized that there was warmth on the infrared rays. Studying spectra is a fairly basic thing for astronomers to do. It's how you identify different types of stars, how you identify different bodies. Everything in the heavens has a different spectrum according to whatever lights it's putting out, whatever the chemical composition is. You can actually determine the chemical composition of planets and stars and so forth by their spectra. He realized at the bottom end of the spectrum there was heat. Of course, Mary Somerville was doing work on exactly that sort of area, which is how they got really involved with each other.
How did Mary manage to reconcile her scientific views of the universe with her very strong religious Christian beliefs?
I guess many of the 19th century scientists were Christians, but not specifically Orthodox at all. Mary said she was no longer subscribed to what she called the gloomy doctrines of Calvinism, which is what she was raised in. She felt that science revealed the awesome power of what she called that great first cause or the deity. So she didn't often refer to God or Christ or anything like that. She talked about the creator or the first cause. And interestingly, she thought that mathematics, which was so powerful in helping us to understand nature, she thought that perhaps showed the power of the deity more than ever. Because when mathematicians discovered these wonderful equations, she says they must have existed in that sublimely omniscient mind from eternity.
On a visit to Paris in 1817, Mary and William were guests of Pierre-Simon Laplace, whose work changed forever the understanding of engineering, statistics, physics, astronomy, probability theory, and much more. He's regarded as possibly the greatest French scientist of all time. Once again, Mary was deeply influenced by another brilliant brain. Dean Rickles is a science historian at Sydney University. Introducing Pierre-Simon Laplace.
Pierre-Simon Marquis de Laplace was originally destined for a career in the church, and he was initially studying theology, but his mathematical gifts became identified after a couple of years, and he left those theological studies unfinished and started his studies of mathematics in Paris. And then he quickly impressed esteemed mathematician Jean-Laurent d'Alembert. D'Alembert was so impressed with Laplace that he engineered a professorial position for a 19-year-old Laplace at the military school where he would eventually meet and examine the 16-year-old Napoleon. So Laplace managed to survive the reign of terror that led to the demise of famous figures like Lavoisier at the hands of the guillotine by not only leaving Paris during the worst of this, but he was also working for the Republicans, the revolutionaries on the side, while somehow staying on good terms with the opposing side as well. Once the extremes of the revolution had subsided, Laplace advanced really quickly, being appointed to the leader of the Paris Observatory by 1795. But it seems that in this role and similar roles that he would take on, he was considered to be far too mathematical and theoretical, and he didn't really understand the importance of actually making real-world observations.
So only a few years after this, he starts that great masterpiece, I suppose, of his, the Mécanique Céleste. Give us just a taste of what that was all about, because that's the work that is so often compared to Newton's Principia.
Exactly. So his main contributions were in this field, which would be considered mathematical astronomy. So this was the five-volume work on the mechanism of the heavens. So what the work did, I mean, it did many things, but its primary achievement is to prove the stability of our solar system. This was the pivotal contribution to this idea of a truly clockwork universe. And it's from this idea that we find what's probably the most famous anecdote of Laplace. The story that Laplace went into state to Napoleon to present him a copy of this great work. And Napoleon had already heard about it, in fact, and thought to have said to Laplace, they tell me you've written this huge book on the system of the universe, and you never once mentioned its creator. And then Laplace is supposed to have said, well, I had no need of that hypothesis. As so often in history, this story seems to have been a little bit modified to make it more interesting or amusing, because the religious views of Laplace were not completely black and white. He's presented as an atheist because of this remark, but he was a Catholic throughout his life, and it seems far more likely that Laplace was pointing out to Napoleon that he was able to get around a problem that Isaac Newton had in his Principia Mathematica with the long-term stability of the solar system. So for Newton, he had to keep this idea that the creator had to periodically intervene to nudge the solar system back into its nice orderly path because it had this sort of instability on Newton's account. So Laplace was able to show that this instability wasn't present in his calculations. So he didn't need the intervention of any kind of creator. So he's able to prove the complete determinism of the system. So it's not necessarily the absence of any creator, but it's the absence of the need for a creator to do anything once this system's been set into motion. So it's a bit more perfectly ordered for Laplace. So he introduced a whole bunch of new mathematical tricks and tools that we still have with us today.
So tell me, talking about mathematics, Laplace's equation, which is still used in so many different areas. Tell me about that, because I'm guessing that would have been one of the things that Mary Somerville would have been interested in.
It's a kind of second-order partial differential equation. I mean, it just has extremely wide applications. Its solutions are these things called harmonic functions, and they occur almost universally. They occur later in electromagnetic problems. You find them in gravitational theory. You can sort of reformulate Newton's theory of gravitation as this completely different theory of what are called gravitational potentials, and this is what Laplace did.
Mary and Laplace remained letter-writing friends until his death in 1827. When Mary's husband, William, received a letter which would change her life forever.
It was from Henry Braun, a co-founder of the liberal literary magazine Edinburgh Review, and he'd met Mary some years earlier. He was writing to ask her to write a popular account of Laplace's Mécanique Céleste. He was asking on behalf of the Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge. He wrote in the letter, "In England, there are not more than 20 people who know this great work." He said there was no one other than Mary that was qualified to write such a book.
Put simply, Mécanique Céleste summarised the theory of gravity in modern mathematical language, and there was nothing simple in that.
Such an extraordinary request to a self-taught woman, especially at a time when women were deemed intellectually inferior and denied higher education. So Mary was amazed.
The letter surprised me beyond expression. I thought Lord Brougham must have been mistaken with regard to my acquirements and naturally concluded that my self-acquired knowledge was so far inferior to that of the men who had been educated in our universities that it would be the height of presumption to attempt to write on such a subject, or indeed on any other.
Once she picked herself up off the floor with the shock of it all and gave it some thought, she decided that she would agree to it, but she had two conditions. First, if Lord Brougham wanted her to explain calculus, especially its Leibnizian form, because it was a much more user-friendly form than the one that Newton had invented at the same time. I mean, they were both saying the same things, but the symbolism was really important, and Leibniz's form made it much more conducive to developing that language further. That was one of the interests of the book, supposedly. But she said if that's what he wanted, it couldn't really be a popular book. It was going to be a more serious work than he'd originally asked for. And two, that it should be a secret. He shouldn't tell anyone. And if she wasn't able to produce something worthwhile, then her manuscript would be burned. Took on this extraordinary challenge.
Mechanism of the Heavens, as she called her book.
For a start, it would run to nearly 700 pages. That tells you the enormity of her task. She decided that she would offer an explicated English translation of the first two volumes of Mécanique Céleste, and she'd fill in some of the advanced math that he'd thought was obvious. That meant that her book would be a standalone exposition of the maths of gravity, especially as it applied to astronomy. Of course, much of that language was due to Newton, and she explained his laws of motion and how his amazing law of gravity showed that the planets really did orbit around the sun and how they did it. And so she gave a lot more detail on basic gravitational theory than Laplace had done. In the century since Newton's death, there'd been a lot of improvements, of course, in both astronomy and maths, especially by the use of Leibnizian calculus. And Laplace took these for granted because, you know, he was in the academy. But Mary, who had had to study them herself and understood how difficult that was for people, she carefully explained them. That made her book really stand out. It's interesting that Newton's brilliant discovery, or one of the foundational discoveries, was proving the elliptical orbits, that a planet moving around the sun or a moon moving around a planet would trace out an elliptical path. That was exactly what Kepler had found by observation, but Newton was able to deduce this as a consequence of the force of gravity. And that was really remarkable. But he also noted that's the two-body problem, just the planet going around the sun. But in fact, there's all the other bodies in the solar system, and they have gravity, and other planets and moons would impact, would push the orbit out of whack a little bit when it came too close. And Newton had assumed that would mean that the planetary harmony wouldn't last forever. Laplace made these extraordinary calculations showing that the solar system is stable for all practical purposes. And Mary was able to follow this incredibly sophisticated work and to translate and explain it. It was a really amazing thing that she was able to do.
Throughout the 3 years Mary Somerville spent writing this, her first major work, she simultaneously managed her roles as a charming hostess, loving wife and mother, while also attending to her many domestic duties. She often had to work in brief intervals between interruptions or late at night. For women then, intellectual pursuits were very much secondary to family obligations, which makes her achievements all the more extraordinary given the limitations she faced. Finally, Mechanism of the Heavens, as she called it, was ready for publication.
It did prove too technical for the original brief, and Lord Brougham pulled the plug. Mary must have been absolutely devastated. Luckily, her ever-supportive husband stepped in, and he approached an innovative London-based Scottish publisher, John Murray.
John Murray's clientele included notable figures such as Jane Austen, Lord Byron, and Charles Darwin.
It helped that the manuscript came with a testimonial from the astronomer John Herschel, who was William's son and had become a good friend of Mary and very supportive of her work. And so Murray was pretty impressed with this. He sort of cautiously agreed to take it on. Mary was 50 years old at this time. This was 1831. And Murray agreed to publish 750 copies of her book because he thought, well, there's not going to be a big audience for this.
So how was it received, both in England and on the continent?
Rapturously.
William Whewell, the professor of moral philosophy at Cambridge and later Master of Trinity, introduced Mary's book, Mechanism of the Heavens, as a text for the advanced science classes at the university. But of course, Mary, being a woman, was not allowed to attend university herself. The book created great excitement in England, not only because of its sheer depth of understanding, but also because it was a book few men could understand and was written by a woman. This is novelist and educational theorist Maria Edgeworth writing to Mary.
I was long in the state of the boa constrictor after a full meal. My mind was so distended by the magnitude, the immensity of what you put into it.
Acknowledging the success of her book, Mary Somerville was elected an honorary member of the esteemed, all-male, Royal Astronomical Society, at the same time as her friend astronomer Caroline Herschel. They were the first women to receive this honor. Both had faced many barriers due to their gender. Despite Mary's strong advocacy of women's education, her support was not without apprehension due to the naive pseudoscience of her time. Through family connections, Mary Somerville became the mathematical mentor of young Ada Lovelace, the daughter of poet Lord Byron. Ada's highly educated mother, Annabella Milbank, wanted her daughter to study maths in the hope that she wouldn't grow up like her father, mad, bad, and dangerous to know. Better stultifying maths than romantic poetry. The early tutors didn't exactly fire Ada's imagination until she met Mary Somerville, who introduced her to Charles Babbage, a brilliant mathematician and pioneer of the programmable computer. Ada's interpretation of Babbage's analytical engine made her famous. It was the first mechanical computer, in theory at least. Alan Dorin is an historian of technology at Monash University. Introducing Ada Lovelace and Charles Babbage.
Babbage had built this machine. He understood how machines worked. He was an engineer. The notes that Lovelace translated from Menabre were written by an engineer, a military engineer. So both of them are approaching the world and these machines as engineers.
Captain Luigi Menabrea, who later became the 7th Prime Minister of Italy, wrote extensive notes following Babbage's talks in Turin in 1840. Ada translated those notes into English.
Lovelace had a broad education, as would have they, but she brought into her description of the machine the poetics of mathematics, the value of art and creativity. She applied her own poetic understanding of machines and the arts generally to a set of extra notes attached to her translation of his original notes. And I think that is indeed what made her name, especially in this area.
Charles Babbage encouraged her, didn't he, to write those notes?
Babbage was a little bit of a cantankerous and difficult person to work with, and I think he recognised that. And he was trying to raise funds for the construction of his analytical engine. And that means that he needed publicity and he needed somebody like Ada Lovelace to provide an external view and to assist him convincing those with money that his machine should be funded and that it was valuable.
And what exactly was the analytical engine? Because it was never built, was it?
No, it was never built. So Babbage had designed and built at least part of a previous engine called the Difference Engine. The Difference Engine was basically a complex calculator. It could just add numbers. While working on that, he had the idea for this analytical engine, which was a lot more sophisticated in that rather than simply manipulating numbers, it enabled people to manipulate algebraic symbols. And those symbols could certainly hold numbers, but by enabling symbol manipulation, the origins, if you like, of modern-day computers were born. One of the key things Ada Lovelace brought to the discussion was recognising that these symbols did not need to be numerical values. If you could manipulate symbols that, say, represented notes in a musical composition, then the machine could be used for things other than mathematics. That allowed her to imagine, for instance, that the machine could be made to compose music that humans might not have composed and assemble very complex compositions that would have been beyond the practical limitations of a human composer, both in terms of their length, but also in their complexity. So I love that she brought to this very engineering-centric thinker the possibility that his machines would one day do much more than mathematics.
The 19th century philosopher and politician John Stuart Mill compared married women to slaves. Their legal identity was absorbed into their husbands, making them his property. They couldn't sign contracts or keep their own earnings. They could be legally beaten. They could be compelled to have sex. If they ran away, the police would return them to their abusive husbands. Mill was author of the early feminist work, The Subjection of Women. Robin Arianrod.
It was a terrible situation, and Mary actually did do some her own experiments and actually published 3 papers, I think it was. But of course, she wasn't allowed to present them. William did it on her behalf to the Royal Society. And she was very impressed when she read Mill's book and wrote to him and also became the first to sign his petition for female suffrage. She'd really been furious, basically, that she and all women were denied a higher education. And so she not only tutored Ada Lovelace, but she taught her own daughters algebra, Latin and Greek, the things that her sons could learn at school.
There was also a slight shadow over this support for female education, wasn't there? Because the fear of mentally harming her daughters, and particularly after the death of her daughter, Margaret.
Margaret died at the age of 10, and she'd been really apparently very brilliant and enjoyed her studies. But even decades later, Mary still wrote,
"I feared I might have strained her young mind too much."
So that idea that she had suffered from, you know, when the candles were confiscated because people thought that women stretching their brains with intellectual stuff would damage their health or even send them mad. And although Mary didn't really believe it, those sorts of things do eat into your soul and your confidence.
Did the intelligentsia of the time really believe that there was some science to this sort of stereotyping of women's brains are going to be addled if they do anything too serious?
19th century anthropologists certainly believed that brain size dictated intelligence. Craniology, you know, measuring skulls to infer characteristics such as intelligence, was still respected in Mary's time. But then in 1871 came Darwin's Descent of Man. And although he himself was reasonably less sexist and racist than many of his contemporaries, he still assumed that evolutionary pressures meant that men had evolved further and so that women were physically and intellectually weaker than men.
When Mary's father discovered her passion for learning, he warned,
"We must put a stop to this, or we'll have Mary in a straitjacket one of these days."
In the 19th century, scientific knowledge, including that of human biology, was surging ahead. But this had a downside for women. When it was discovered that women's brains were smaller than men's on average. Marje Henneberg is an emeritus professor of anthropological and comparative anatomy at the University of Adelaide. He's a neuroanthropologist.
A person even as bright as Mary Somerville was influenced by then prevailing scientific views and opinions. In the 19th century, we knew very little about functions of the brain, and most of what was known was related to brain anatomy, brain structure, brain size.
Do you think that this was just reinforcing the gender stereotype at the time? Or did people really believe that scientifically we've actually discovered the truth here?
Well, I think these two things were related. belief in science progressing very quickly and developing is also related to stereotypes. And one of the stereotypes was this brain size and intelligence. The bigger brains think better. Until today, science sometimes justifies by precise measurements and observations some common stereotypes. I think this was a stereotype, but it was then strengthened by scientific observations. We know now that the difference in size between male and female brains is on the average about 10% of the brain size, whereas there is a huge overlap. There are many females whose brains are much bigger than brains of some males. So the difference is only on the average. And likewise, it does not show in formal psychological tests of mental aptitude. The results of those mental aptitude tests do not correlate with brain size of their owners.
When did the idea that brain size was linked to intelligence, when was that idea debunked?
Is still being debunked. There were still papers 20 years ago published based on new magnetic resonance measurements of the inside of the brains, still showing that brain size has some relation to mental abilities. It's very difficult to debunk socially established beliefs. Harry Jerison, who published a book about the evolution of brain intelligence, where he linked the size of the brain of various animals to their intelligence, to their mental abilities. So we still have this belief appearing here and there. And the other problem that occurred was in human evolution. The evolutionists were showing that as animal brains become bigger, animals are more intelligent, more mentally able. And in human evolution, evolution of hominins, brain size was increasing for at least the last 4 million years. It was increasing gradually. And obviously, as the brain size of our ancestors got bigger, their tools became more sophisticated and evidence of their behaviors was greater. And so that seemed to support the idea of bigger is better. However, in the last 10,000 years, after the end of Ice Age and when people started inventing agriculture and animal husbandry and so on, brain size started decreasing substantially. So by about 150 milliliters, half a wine glass.
So what exactly does make for greater intelligence? Do we even know?
Well, we are beginning to know. What it is brain physiology that influences ability to think. It's a biochemical regulation of the brain. We often think about the brain as simply a computer. Yes, there are a lot of nerve cells, neurons in the brain, especially in the brain cortex, and those neurons talk to each other. And the more signals go between neurons or the more neurons we have, then we can solve more problems. However, the brain communication and communication between neurons depends on their chemical surrounding, and especially sending a signal from one nerve cell to the other through the gap called the synapse. And the neurotransmitters interfere with transmission of signals through those synapses, and easily changing levels of neurotransmitters may interfere with the signal that go from one nerve cell to the other. And this is probably what is underlying ability to solve mental problems.
Mary Somerville's second book on the connection of the physical sciences, 1834, highlighted the mathematical link between the expanding scientific fields at the time. It became a bestseller with 10 UK editions and was also published in Germany and France, though pirated in America. The book was aimed at women and dedicated to Queen Adelaide.
If I have succeeded in my endeavour to make the laws by which the material world is governed more familiar to my countrywomen, I shall have the gratification of thinking that the gracious permission to dedicate my book to Your Majesty has not been misplaced.
She did want to write a more popular level book than Mechanism of the Heavens, and it covered some of the same ground, but in much less mathematical detail. She discussed amazing things like the flattening of the Earth at the poles and how the formula for Newton's gravity enabled you to weigh the Earth if you knew certain constants in there. Of course, she talked about the stability of the solar system. And interesting, I think it was in the sixth edition of the book, which was published in about 1842, she wrote about difficulties in calculating the position of Uranus. It seemed that that wasn't following Newton's laws properly. There was a bit of a perturbation going on there. And she thought, well, maybe there's an undiscovered planet that's disturbing its orbit. And that hint inspired the British astronomer John Couch Adams to begin the calculations that ultimately led him to the co-discovery of the existence of Neptune. So she certainly was fascinated by how maths could unravel the mysteries of the universe and make them awesome for everybody. That was the Newtonian side, but she discussed all the other new discoveries that had been taking place in the early 1800s, and especially, as the title suggests, the connections between them. She talked about William Herschel's discovery in 1801 of infrared radiation and how it linked colour and heat. She described her friend William Wollaston's discovery of the absorption spectrum, which was produced when chemicals in the atmosphere absorb different colours, leaving tiny black lines in the spectrum of the light that passes through, although they didn't quite know that at the time. But it was an interesting connection between chemistry, if you like, and light. Then after the invention of the battery and then all the wonderful experiments that were being done on electricity and magnetism, culminating in the discovery of electromagnetism, the connection between the two, by Hans Oersted and Mary's own dear friend Michael Faraday. And years later, she'd write that he was the greatest experimental philosopher and discoverer next to Newton.
Dr. Susie Shee is a physicist with research groups at both Oxford and Melbourne universities. Introducing Michael Faraday.
Michael Faraday was born in 1791. He came from quite a poor background. He was the son of a blacksmith. He was apprenticed to a bookbinder when he was young, and he used that access to the latest books of the day to feed his curiosity about science.
How do we get from that humble beginning to basically changing modern lives altogether?
He was inspired by three key books in his childhood, effectively. And one was written by a woman, Jane Marcet, called Conversations on Chemistry. And that's where he got an interest in chemistry and electricity. He was interested in the Encyclopedia Britannica. There was an article in there about electricity that got him fascinated in that. And another book called The Improvement of the Mind by Isaac Watt. And that kind of set him on the course to follow a more intellectual path in his life. And so at this young age, he's attending lectures, for example, at the Philosophical Society. You could pay just a shilling and attend this course of lectures. He's self-educating in science. And so at the age of about 20, he gets a chance to attend some lectures at the famous Royal Institution in London. And so he goes there to attend lectures given by one of the preeminent physicists of the day, Humphry Davy. He gets this idea to ask Davy for a job. And the way he does that is he has this habit when he watches lectures of taking detailed notes. And so he sends Davy a bound book of detailed notes asking for a job, and Davy turns him down. But luckily, not long after that, the same year, 1812, an opening happened and Davy remembered Faraday. And this time he was given a job as an assistant. He has access to learning. He has access to all the people who were developing these ideas. And he has access to a well-equipped laboratory in the basement of the Royal Institution where he can carry out experiments. And by 1820, so that's 8 years after joining the Royal Institution, he's publishing original research, sending papers to the Royal Society. About 4 years later, he becomes a fellow of the Royal Society, and later he becomes director of the Royal Institution, goes on to do experiments, particularly around electricity and magnetism, that absolutely transformed the understanding of those phenomena and led to his principle of induction, which we still call Faraday's principle of induction, ideas like the electric motor, like power generation that we need every day for our electricity today.
There was also another side to him which, to be honest, I'd never even heard of, that he was one of the early pioneers of what we'd call environmental science, as well as being a conscientious objector.
My understanding is some of his investigations that ended up being what we'd call environmental science were kind of motivated by the state or by the crown, because he was in some ways a sort of public servant. But it seems to have been Faraday himself who actually recognised how poor a state the River Thames was in. Thinking back to London in this period, think basically the River Thames is a sewer. It's getting all the offflow from factories. People are washing things, and he referred to it as a fermenting sewer. And so he uses his chemical knowledge to investigate that and publishes his findings in a letter to the Times and to Parliament, warning everybody that was potentially a danger and the Thames water needed to be purified. Now, Parliament ignored it, but within 3 years, his prophecy kind of came true because they had a particularly hot summer. You can just imagine this fermenting sewer of a river being heated up on a high 30-degree day and the sewage started to steam and covered the entire city in this horrible odour they call the Great Stink. And this motivated Parliament finally to do something about it and to agree to build a Victorian sewage system and embankments along the river as well. And it took about 3 years for the river to sort of come back to a relatively good state of health. And as you noted, he was also a bit of a pacifist. He was asked to actually help develop chemical warfare methods for the Crimean War, and he refused to do that, citing ethical reasons.
Mary Somerville's book on the connection of the physical sciences was an overwhelming success, as Robin Arianrod, affiliate in mathematics at Monash University, writes in her own book, Seduced by Logic.
Mary's high-level scientific writing helped shape the identity of the emerging, increasingly professionalised scientific community, and it helped educate young scientists at a time when Britain had fallen behind France and Germany in mathematical physics. Another topic she discussed in Connections was optics. She began her discussion of light by noting the glorious atmospheric effects at sunset. In this spirit of wonder, she added,
"It is impossible to trace the path of a sunbeam through our atmosphere without feeling a desire to know its nature and by what power it traverses the immensity of space."
She went on to describe Newton's particle theory of light, but she claimed that Thomas Young's experiments had proved once and for all that light was transmitted as a wave, not a particle.
Ruth Morgan is an environmental historian at the Australian National University. Introducing Thomas Young.
Thomas Young demonstrated that light moved rather differently to what Newton had presumed. He used the famous double slit experiment to show, in fact, that light moved in a wave-like motion. And this was such a shocking suggestion, really, and it took some time for it to become accepted among contemporaries. In fact, it was colleagues across the Channel in France that were able to substantiate and confirm what Thomas Young proposed. It really took some time to shift that orthodoxy that had emerged around Isaac Newton's theory.
But in fact, today we believe it's both, don't we? The wave-particle duality, as they call it in quantum physics.
Yes, that's quite interesting how at the time there was the view that, well, we can't possibly overturn Newton's position on these matters. And then Thomas Young proposes his controversial interpretation of light. And Mary Somerville is quite supportive of Thomas Young's theory. And she expresses some surprise that, well, particles could not possibly annihilate each other as Newton had proposed. And since then, and much more recently in the 20th century with quantum physics, we now know that antiparticles do exist. And when they encounter their particle counterparts, they can indeed annihilate each other. So it's quite interesting how long it takes and the kinds of research that might have unexpected or unintended implications for perhaps the orthodoxy of a long-held position. So it just goes to show sometimes these matters aren't ever fully put to rest.
Thomas Young's biographer, Andrew Robinson, described him as the last man who knew everything. Young was a polymath, a medical doctor, physicist, mathematician. He spoke Greek, Latin, Hebrew, French, Persian, Arabic and German, and was fascinated by Egyptology.
He was one of that scientific social circle that she and her husband had established when they moved to London. Mary recounts a lovely story about being out with some of the other friends in that group, and they were looking at the stars through a telescope till 2 a.m. and on their way home, they saw a light in Young's window. So they called in, and although he was in his dressing gown, he welcomed them in, showed them how he'd just been able to date an ancient Egyptian horoscope by using astronomy. And he's very famous for his work on Egyptian hieroglyphics, but of course, even more so for his wave theory of light. And Mary especially admired that remarkable work on how light actually propagated.
Trinity Professor William Whewell was one of the most influential figures in 19th century Britain. In his review of Mary's book on the connection of the physical sciences, Whewell praised her as
a person of real science
for unifying contemporary scientific knowledge, and he marvelled at the fact it was a woman doing this, given his rather poor opinion of women's intellectual abilities.
One of the characteristics of the female intellect is a clearness of perception as far as it goes. With them, action is the result of feeling. The heart goes on with its own concerns, asking no counsel of the head, and in return, the working of the head, if it does work, is not impeded by its having to solve questions.
Whewell obviously made a great exception when it came to Mary Somerville. His endorsement went a long way to cementing her reputation, even if he does end the review by calling her
one of the brightest ornaments of England.
Mary and William Somerville had visited the continent many times, and in 1838 they went to live in Italy for both economic and health reasons. Even so, Mary was able to write two more books. The first, Physical Geography, in 1848, was surprisingly controversial for her.
The controversy came because one of the topics that she covered was geology. New research there had been dating the age of the Earth, doing the geological record and fossil record. And those estimates of the age of the Earth showed that the biblical estimates were far too short. And so Mary did recall that the outcry over this was more heated even than the later debates over evolution. She was not orthodox in her religious belief. She did note wryly that the minister at York Cathedral had preached a sermon against geology and had singled her out for particular chastisement as a key proponent of this supposedly heretical new subject. It's interesting because one of her key messages is the interconnectedness of humans and the planet.
Her last book on molecular and microscopic sciences, published when she was 88 years old, was a disappointment to her.
The molecular structure of matter was still hypothetical at that time. This is 1869 she published it, and the electron wouldn't be discovered until 1895, and the nucleus of the atom in 1911. So she was going out on a limb, really. Interestingly, she said in a memoir, well, I should have kept to maths. That was my real love.
In her late 80s, Mary Somerville was almost deaf and suffered from arthritis, but was intellectually as healthy as ever. She began to revise an earlier, unpublished mathematical manuscript on curves and surfaces. Her husband, William, had died when he was 89. It had been a warm and successful partnership.
My memory of ordinary events, and especially of the names of people, is failing, but not for mathematical and scientific subjects. I am still able to read the books on the higher algebra for 4 or 5 hours in the morning.
And yet still she doubted herself and what her legacy might be. This is an extract from another of Mary's unpublished manuscripts.
In the climax of my great success, the approbation of some of the first scientific men of the age and of the public in general, I was highly gratified, but much less elated than I expected. For although I had recorded in a clear point of view some of the most refined and difficult mathematical prophecies and astronomical discoveries, I was conscious that I had made no discovery myself, that I had no originality. I have perseverance and intelligence, but no genius.
She certainly had an impact on her times, but I think she's also had an enduring legacy as a role model for young women in particular, but also for anyone who needs encouragement to follow their dream, despite the obstacles. For me, her legacy's there in that I'm one of those who took encouragement from her struggle.
Mary Somerville confronted death through the prism of her Christian faith and her seafarer's upbringing.
The Blue Peter has been long flying at my foremast, and now that I'm in my 92nd year, I must soon expect the signal for sailing. It is a solemn voyage, but it does not disturb my tranquility.
Mary Somerville, the self-educated Scot, was a supremely gifted mathematician and scientist. She remains largely unacknowledged today. If only that brilliance had been recognised and nurtured earlier, who knows what else she could have achieved?
That celebration of Mary Somerville was written and presented by Sharon Carleton. Next week, Miriam Rothschild. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.